whether you're right or whether you're wrong. And by right or wrong, I mean, we were looking for a child one day on Sutter Avenue. Traffic was heavy. We're in a stopped situation. The car in front of us pulls up, and this car rides coming up the wrong way on a two-lane street now. He's facing us on the wrong way, and he got out and was a Puerto Rican man. He was drunk. On the sidewalk was, and we were in a Puerto Rican neighborhood, so they were playing dominoes and playing the guitar and drinking, you know.
And again, this is in Brooklyn.
Yeah, this is in Brooklyn. And we call it the Puerto Rican neighborhood because, you know, everybody has territory. So this guy gets out and he's telling us to move the car. You got to move your car. Now, we got traffic behind us. We're all in the right. Right? So that we realize the man was drunk, you know. So he takes a swing at my friend. So he ducks him. You know, we're not trying to get in no trouble. So, you know, they start looking, you know. So he hit at him again. So Melvin hit the guy, you know, and his head went on the windshield. And blood started coming out of his mouth and out of his ear. So then they, you know, then they looked and they started coming over. And they were going to be on this man's side, seeing what had happened, you know. But the thing was that it was a black Puerto Rican thing. Whether the man was right or wrong, they were going to stand with him, you know. And black people don't understand that. You know, and I might as well say it, we just have a problem helping each other, you know. I look at that, even though the man was wrong, they stick together, they help each other, they buy each other cars, and they help each other, you know, do better and rise above. And we look at that as a character flaw, but it's not. And if you look at other races, that's what they do. They help each other, you know. So I think as far as the black race looking at not only the Mexicans but other races, we have a problem with that because we don't help each other. We're getting there, you know, we're getting there. But, you know, that's a whole nother story. But I think there's generally a mistrust within our culture.
The black culture?
Yeah. Or? You know, I mean, to be truthful, you know, I don't know what it is, you know. Well, I have my ideas of what it is, and it's deeply rooted, but I'm not talking about that.
Well, you can if you want to.
Well, I think that as a race, what happened to us when we were put into the slavery situation and separated the way that we were, you know, there was already tribal warfare going on before we got here. So if they found you to be of the same tribe, they would split you up. So here you are with an enemy. Okay, so you're not going to trust that person when you've been fighting for 50 years over in the homeland, and everybody's, you know. So that takes a long time to get out of, you know. And there are some theories about gangs and tribes. You know, people feel safe in a gang. People feel safe in the tribe, okay? So anyway, that's another story, but I don't let people tell me that. I don't let slavery affect me now. That's got nothing to do with you've got all your rights, you've got the ability to do anything you want to do. Nobody owes you anything. Okay? And people, well, you know, they're trying to beat the, you know, get, you know, the mentality has to change. And I think it is slowly. You know.
This mistrust that you talked about. Have you seen this manifested, just in terms of this area here, and through your work, either with the children or?
I've heard some things. people will say, oh, you know, the Mexicans, they got this, they're taking over this, yeah, and they're doing yeah. this, and they're doing that. Yeah. Yes, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting back watching them, you know,
mm-hmm.
take over because you know, you're doing a lot of this, talking, but you have the same opportunity, if not more,
mm-hmm.
you see? So, yeah, it's like, well, back in Virginia, there was a segment of society they called white trash.
Mm-hmm.
And they hated the blacks more because they felt threatened on that level. You know, they were mm-hmm. competing for the same type of jobs. Yeah. And so, therefore, you know, they were like the rednecks or the, you know, whatever they want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you see what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a segment of society that's going to be at each other's throat because they feel threatened by each other. But, you know, I don't allow that. For instance, these kids now, you know, well, the Muslims are kind of backing off from that hate thing, you know. Well, the white man is a devil.
That's
and he's
right.
A, yeah. I said, look, now, see, when I got to Washington, I could get in the front of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
See, from Richmond to Washington, I had to ride in the back of the bus. So now that you have the right to ride in the front of the bus, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Smoking, cussing, bothering people. You know, you see what I'm saying? What are you doing with the rights that you have? Nothing. But yet you complain when somebody else comes over and gets ahead.
So you think there's a lack, in some cases there may be a lack of black initiative to...
In some cases,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know. And I think it goes back to the white trash scenario.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we're down here in this barrel
mm-hmm.
fighting for these jobs, and here comes these people getting these jobs. But if you really wanted that job, or if you wanted to better yourself, you have the opportunity instead of, you know, sitting mm-hmm. around talking about it, you know. But I think that's kind of disappearing somewhat, but there's still a large segment of that still around.
Within
you
know. This...
Yeah.
Within North...
Yeah.
So this mentality yeah. within this neighborhood. You mentioned just in terms of the demographics, which is really helpful in terms of some neighborhoods making the transition to predominantly Latino. And I was just wondering, as this transition is taking place, are the black residents choosing to go somewhere else, or are they...
Well, apparently, because most of these, I know that, what's the name of that place, it's on Austin Avenue. I go there to pick up some kids on Saturday. But it used to be black.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's all Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. And I have my theories on that too. I see houses that when I come on Roswell Road that have been empty, but now there's Mexican families there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, this is only what I think.
Sure.
I think that these landlords prefer to rent to a Mexican person because they know they're going to get their money.
Right.
It's unfortunate. Well, it's not unfortunate that they rent, but like I say, these people, now, there's some out there that drink, but that's in every race.
Yes.
There's always some bad with the good.
Mm-hmm.
But these are hardworking people. They know that the only way they're going to stay here is that they have to pay their way.
Mm-hmm.
The landlords know that if mm-hmm. I rent this property, I'm going to get my money.
Hmm.
So when they apply for these places, they have a reputation for that.
Hmm.
You see? So that's the same thing that happened in Brooklyn. You know, they'll come and they'll all gang up together for a while, but when they get strong, they move out. But while they're ganged up together, they're going to make sure the rent's paid,
hmm.
they're going to pay the bills,
mm-hmm.
they're going to buy that 25-pound bag of rice and their beans, they're going to have something to eat, you
mm-hmm.
know. And it's that's what helps them survive. You know?
Interesting. Well, that's a perspective I hadn't heard of before, just in terms of maybe, I don't know, sort of the motivation behind.
Well, you know, I call it the poverty mentality,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we fight against here, you know. Getting the system, getting your food stamps, and you know, and I see it here. With certain information, we try to collect that we can't get because people are getting these vouchers, they're working, they're driving these big vans, you know, well, how do you, you know. So people are still trying to get over with this poverty mentality, okay? And they don't have that mentality. If we went to Mexico, which I don't have enough guts, I couldn't go to another country and try to start over or try to get a job and make my way where I didn't speak the, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. They're coming because there's opportunity.
Right.
Okay? And they know that you have to work, you have to earn your way. You see? And that's what they do. As far as the business community is concerned, I know I was doing a little painting there for a while, and they were getting a lot of jobs because they were undercutting the price. So,
yeah.
I don't have no problem. I can't do it for that price, you know. So now, because well, those Mexicans are coming, they're getting all of our work. But there's work for you. There's work for the Mexicans. The work is here. You see what I'm saying? So you just have to find something else to do, you know. But people look at that as a threat when it's really not a threat. You see? And then when they say the price, I say, well, how can they do that? Well, they can do it because they're all living together and they pool that money together. Even though it sounds ridiculous to you, to them, it's a living, you see? So I understand what they're doing. If I could do it, I'd do it too. But we don't want to do it, you see? So that's how they get to where they are and how they, you know, they come, they'll go to an auction, they'll pool their money together and buy a car, they'll all ride around that car until they work some more, they'll go buy another car, you see? And to me, that's the way you're supposed to do it. You know, and people resent that, you know, and then they see him getting ahead and moving out, and then they go back to Mexico, me and it, you know. So, I don't know. I just don't have a problem with other nationalities moving in because I've lived with that, you know.
And, live with that from your...
And you know, in New York. As a matter of fact, it kind of helped me get where I got because of this quota system that was back then. That's really why they hired me. They would never tell me that, but they had to have a certain amount of blacks in a position. So that helped us out a bit. But I don't think I'm by myself in this opinion, but... I think that's exactly what's happening here in North Carolina. Again, Durham, the Research Triangle area is sort of, again, sort of a melting pot area. So it's kind of unfair with the, I guess if you get out into the more rural areas where it's mainly black and white, there would probably be more of a problem there. You know, but I can't speak about that. You know, I'm just going by what I think. You know, because you're introducing something totally new. You know. And as I travel around, you know, these farm areas, there's a lot of Mexican people that are willing to live in those little trailers and work on the farm. And we're not going to do that.
You know?
So they'll take opportunities that we see as I don't know what we look at them as, you know. But, and people appreciate that, you know.
I was wondering if you could just give me a little, sort of a dose of your family when you're leaving Brooklyn for Durham in 81. Where did you settle when you got here in terms of neighborhood? And, yeah, where did you settle?
Okay, well, we came down and got involved with the real estate man, John Javis Martin. And actually, I was looking for an area that was close to the highway so I could get down to Sanford every day without a whole lot of local traffic. And we looked around Austin Avenue, which is Highway 55, which connects me up to US 1. And they took me into some nice places, some not so nice places. So we ended up on Real Road, which was a block off of Austin Avenue, Highway 55. So all I had to do was shoot down go down south a little bit, hit US 1, and I was in Sanford about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So people thought I was absolutely insane, crazy, because I would ride an hour. And I said, you get on that subway for an hour and you see what the difference is. You know? But it had gotten so bad, I got on the subway one stop away from the last stop, or the first stop, coming to work, and then before the last stop going home. And the train was packed.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to two stations, everybody off, trains out of service. Now you got a whole train full of people that's got to get into another whole train load of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know, it was a mess.
Mm-hmm.
So when you travel like that for several years, you know, to me, driving down a nice scenic highway for an hour is a pleasure. You know? But they didn't quite see it that way. So I did that for 3 years until they sold the company. And our jobs in between ended up in Burlington for 8 years, going down 85. So anyway, we ended up on that side of town. When I lost my job, I got into a lot of financial difficulty. We had to leave that house, and we moved over into Umpstead Street, which is another Dodge City part of town. And
what year was that? Do you remember?
83. That was sort of like the back to the ghetto again, and but it allowed us to get on our feet. It was a big old house, drafty and windy, but we made it through. And I was doing security work. I was working 7 days a week for 2 years, and still not making the money that I, you know. So I got a call from a guy and ended up in Burlington, pretty much back where I was financially. And one night I just heard some bullets. I said, well, we got to get out of here. And my credit had gotten so bad, I ended up over on Pineland with a rent-to-own situation, one of those Bobby Roberts houses.
What's a Bobby Roberts house?
I guess we better not go any further with that. But he's a construction man, built a lot of these houses in Durham, and what he would do would, he would allow you to move in as a renter with the option to buy, and he took a chance with the credit history that I had at the time, so, you know, it was a good thing. So we were able to get into that three-bedroom house, and we stayed there until the ministry bought the house that we're in now as the parsonage. So we located where we did on Riddle Road mainly because of the access to the highway going to Sanford.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to move from there because of financial situations to Umpstead Street, which was back in the hood, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved out to Pineland again, which was a pretty quiet neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're out on off of Old Oxford Highway on Lazywood Lane, which is a very nice area.
Is that outside of?
No, it's still in Durham County. Yeah.
So, but outside of the of this neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
Okay. Going north. So, I mean, there is a house on the property, but pastors, we don't live on a house connected to the church and never sleep.
So
a lot of pastors don't even live in Durham.
That's true.
So we just, that property became available, so we moved out there.
And when did you do that?
I guess it's about going on 3 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could give me the genesis of how you became involved in the ministry at this particular church.
Okay, that's another story. Okay, we started at Orange Grove Baptist Church, and my wife was ordained. No, she was licensed to preach at that church, which was kind of a, you know, they weren't too into licensing and ordaining women as ministers, which is changing. I was a trustee at the time, and you know, did my job and was faithful and did what I was supposed to do. There was a big fight, church mess, big split, pastor left, and I stayed and my wife left, you know, because I'm a trustee, you know, and I have one. So anyway, I went to a meeting one day and they started doing some things that, as far as I'm concerned, you know, getting up, calling each other liars and this and that in a church meeting. That was the end of it for me. So I left. Now, I had no church, so my wife had started to go into the full gospel circles. And I went with her after several months of prodding. And the next week, so anyway, I finally went to a church over here not far called Monroe Evangelical. And we were introduced to the full gospel as opposed to the Baptist. Now, here again, there's 59,000 denominations. But the difference in the full gospel is that we just believe everything that's in the Bible, everything from cover to cover. So I got there and people are doing stuff and praising God, and I'm going like, what are these people doing in here? You know, coming from the, you know, the Baptist mentality. And then I really had an experience. You know, I really, I call it, I found the truth, let's put it that way. And then I really, you know, started embracing a little bit more studying and stuff like that. So I was made a deacon. And my wife eventually was ordained a minister in the full gospel circles. And while all that was going on, we were having a family devotion every Saturday at 8 o'clock. And if you're not there, you get your legs broken, as far as my children are concerned. So we did that. Then here comes another church problem. Okay, so the pastor left again. So now we're going around trying to find another church. But in the meantime, we're having this family devotion. Here comes people, you know, well, can I come to your family devotion? You know, okay. So now we look around, there's 15 people sitting in the living room. So God just spoke to my wife and says, look, you know, you need to start. This is a church. This is not a family devotion. So we started over there at Campus Hills Community Center with 8 people. And we stayed there for about 3 months, and we moved to a quieter place over here on Harvard Street. It was called East End Community Center. It was more of a private, you know, you didn't have the swimming and everybody looking through the door. And we grew to about 50 members there. And then this church on Avondale and Markham, which was the Church of the Nazarene, was for rent, so we ended up getting in there, and we grew to 300, and we, there was no more room, people were sitting on the windowsills, you know. Then, this is really the miracle, getting into this building. They wanted $1.3 million, then they went down to $790,000, and that's when we actively tried to pursue the finances. And when they looked at our history,
and who's they again?
The banks.
Yeah.
He said, well, you know, who are you? You know, I mean, you're not even on the map. So, anyway, it turned out we couldn't get any finances. We went to self-help. They were willing to give us $300,000. So, anyway, we went back and forth for quite a while. Ended up with a bond issue. And with the history that we did have, we made them an offer of $450,000, which they accepted, which was a miracle. And we did that through a bond issue. So within a year's time, the bond issue paid back the bank, because we had to borrow the money from the bank to pay for the property. and then pay the bank back through the bond issue. So within a year's time, all of that had been accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
So the bank's paid back. Now what we have now is a 15-year sinking fund to pay back the bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's working very well. And we've already taken out another bond issue, and we had some pipes and sprinkler systems and stuff we had to put in. So that's all paid for and done.
Mm-hmm.
So what we consider our mortgage now is actually a sinking fund that we pay back the bonds on, and that's working well.
Yes.
And most of the members bought them, so everybody, it's, you know, it's a 7 to 10% interest,
mm-hmm.
which no bank is giving. So it was a good deal all the way around.
Yeah.
So that's how we got in this building, and then...
And what year was that?
From 300, that's about 3 years
okay.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're to about 603, and still
in terms
going.
Of membership.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
That's great.
So... there's no telling what's going to happen on this corner. But that's sort
mean?
Of a short history. I mean, I don't know. We have a vision from God that he gave us,
mm-hmm.
and he's providing for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening, you know.
Yes.
So we started a day school last year with K-4 and K-5, and we're going to add first grade this year. We opened up our infant center last Wednesday, and we have a daycare that we started about a year after we got in. So hopefully we can take them from 6 months to the 12th grade at some point. And we hope to build something across the street. So like I say, you know, God gave us a work to do in this neighborhood, and he's providing for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what we're here for, the neighborhood. We're not here to entertain each other.
Right.
Out these doors and evangelize. You know, mm-hmm. And we work with other ministries.
I guess one very important component of your work is... child evangelism, children's evangelism.
Well, we also have the adult evangelism. Tuesday night, they have classes out here in the trailers. And what they do is a 13-week course, and they teach people how to evangelize adults.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they actually, as part of their training, they go out, they get in their cars, and they go in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and they knock on doors, and they put their lab work, to say, to actual practice. You know. And what's happening is changing the neighborhood. You know, some people came in here last night from a couple of houses up here and got saved, you know, and said, well, we just live right up the street.
Hmm.
So, you know, the more doors you knock on, the more people that you touch, these people over here are starting to come around that house right there.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get that. We just didn't have enough funds. We got everything else except that house right there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's making a change. You know, it's making a change. And so we have I'm with the child evangelism and the adult evangelism group because I believe that it's a body ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now is that, like I said, you know, we have an evangelistic group called Taking It to the Street. So they'll go over to the projects and set up some hot dogs and this and that and, you know, give them a word and sing a song and do some stepping or whatever. And 20 people get saved, but then the next day, you can't find them.
Yeah.
Then you got the Muslims coming in. Then you got this group coming in. Then you got that group coming in. And you can't come to my church unless you have a suit.
Yeah.
Or you can't come unless you wear all white. Or you can't wear earrings and necklaces or lipstick to my church. And you know, it's not about your church. You know, and,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I realized. I said, well, we're out here, where's the fruit?
Right.
You know. Well, they just heard another message from the full gospel. Now tomorrow they'll listen to the Baptist and then they'll listen, you know. And what do you have? You have confusion. You see? Now, if we all get together, and that's another thing that we can't do, churches, God's people.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with the Baptists? You know, now, as far as the Jehovah's and the Muslims, you know, I have no agreement with them, so we can't walk together. But as far as the doctrine of Jesus Christ, there's a whole lot of denominations that fit within that mm-hmm. umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not over there talking about salvation
mm-hmm.
and Jesus, and then let them make a decision as to what denomination they want to join, you know, instead of throwing the denomination first,
right.
you know. So hopefully, you know, and I'm not trying to overpower anybody. I'm just trying to come with a consistent message.
Mm-hmm.
So what both of these groups do is they follow up. So if we pick that kid up on Saturday, then the previous Friday night, somebody's been to that house. How you doing? You know, we come to check on you. You know, you're coming tomorrow, sign up the sheet, we'll be here with the bus. So they're getting acquainted with a face. Mm-hmm. It could be a white face, a black face, a blue face. And when people say, oh, you know, these people, you know, they're consistent. They're coming and they're checking on us. You know, they might care about us, you know. So what's happening now is that each Saturday, two or three or four or five begin to understand what salvation is about,
mm-hmm.
who Jesus is, and they begin to accept him in his life. Now, what do? We are saying that this church is available. Mr. Brown's church is available, First Baptist, and that's about the only two active churches that we have in the program right now. So if you're willing, and if you want to, sign up on the sheet, and we'll come pick you up and bring you to service.
Mm-hmm. Now, how's the whole, because I know Mr. Brown has really reached out to kids.
That also includes the Mexicans, because we
yes,
do have Mexicans.
Yes, and I wanted to see if you could touch upon that. How did you two, I guess, guys come, you and Mr. Brown come together as part of this effort to reach out to black and Latino children specifically?
Now, Mr. Brown is the one who contacted me about it because
mm-hmm.
John Blake, who runs this thing, was out of town.
Mm-hmm.
So he was handling it for him while he was away. And he approached us with the child evangelism thing, and they were having a meeting over at Greater St. Paul. So I grabbed my youth department, and we went over there to the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the concept, and so did many others here in this church, and they agreed to be a part of this thing. And this was about maybe a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is they saw a program in Brooklyn where they bus the children in and they teach them, they play games and they teach them and they have a little, you know, it's a good time, but it's also a learning time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And somehow the message gets across to them. So they went up there and checked that program out, and that's what we're implementing now. And it's working. So I guess after that meeting, again, about a year later, then they were actually ready to start. Okay, so then we had a series of meetings here to get the people back together and involved in it, and the room was packed out. Now, when the first Saturday came to go pick these children
mm-hmm.
up, we're back down to the skeleton crew. You know, these people talk the good game,
right.
You know, and I'm some of my members too, because I'm still beating them over the head. Yeah, we'll be there, you know, and I have two that are actively participating in this area,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there could have been more,
mm-hmm.
you know. So now it's at the point where the children are really, you know, in small groups, they're coming around, you know, now they're professing Christ, now they're getting themselves saved. But now you need to join somebody's church or get involved with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are now. So hopefully, and they're working on these lists and things, so between First Baptist and us, you know, we'll take them if they're willing to come, not forcing them.
Right.
But we'll be glad to have them, let's put it that way.
So you also, along with Mr. Brown, drive
yeah.
the church
van? Well, I drive one of the buses. Because that's what I volunteered to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't really have the time to, you know, do the counseling and knock on the doors,
mm-hmm.
but I agreed to drive the bus,
mm-hmm.
and I do what I agreed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two of my deacons and one other guy that drive faithfully on Saturday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what I committed to was transportation, and that's what we're providing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, I'm out there. Like I say, I put my money where my mouth is.
Yeah, and when I spoke to Mr. Brown, a concern of his was that, and which you voiced as well, that there was not nearly enough cooperation between among the various churches, and including black churches.
Well, here's what we find, and I do have some friends in the ministry, and I don't think it's a totally selfish thing, but what I realize they haven't realized yet is that you can't do it by yourself anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, then you're going about it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand, you know, if you're a Baptist church, you're a full gospel church, they're mainly talking doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what's happening, when you get all these different messages in your head, you know, you're talking about religion and not about Jesus Christ and salvation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but somehow they feel that, well, we're already doing it. It's like Liberty, the church that was here before.
Mm-hmm.
They are still picking up children in the neighborhoods, mm-hmm, and taking them out to their church. So we said, look, you know, why can't we get together? Oh, no, we're already, you know, we pick up hundreds of kids. You know, we're doing this and we, you know. Well, as long as they're getting Jesus, you know, that's not such a bad thing,
mm-hmm,
you know. But we got people from Raleigh, Eagle's Nest. They come over, I think, twice a month. And they're picking up kids in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't the neighborhood churches get together and go over there and say, all I'm saying is say the same thing,
mm-hmm,
and give the people the right to choose where they want to be churched. That's all I'm saying. And then you eliminate all that other stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they just, you know, they just feel that they've been doing stuff for years and it's working and this and that, you know. Well, is it working? You know, the groups, you're picking up a group and you've got that group acclimated, fine. You know, but what about the ones that are not acclimated, the ones that are still confused?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and you've got a lot of people already going in that neighborhood. You know, why can't you help reach out to others? And instead of just, you know, I got my group, you know, but there's more, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I really don't know what. So we just go on with the faithful few. You know, not that this is the only program and that it's the only one that's working, because it's not. But I feel that if you're going to really get some fruit, then you can do it, you know, on a less confusing,
mm-hmm,
basis. You know? And then everybody still can benefit if you're looking for members. You know, we're not... We have members, but we're not out there advertising for members.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So, and then everybody can't deal with these people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they'll send money, but, you know, look, I wonder when we'll be around the kids, you know.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to deal. Somebody took time with me,
mm-hmm,
you know. And I know that all they need, you know, they may not embrace it, but if you even plant that seed now, you know, somewhere in their lives, they heard about Jesus. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. We're just going to continue to do the very best that we can. You know, I think as this program develops and as they get some, I think they're going to do some videos and things to, I guess, if you want to say, help persuade or show people what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not out there competing for souls, you know.
Right.
Or bodies or whatever you want to call it.
Right. Just based on your knowledge, I was hoping if you could assess how much outreach had been done by black churches to really reach out to Latinos or...
Well,
to sponsor activities to try to bring black Latinos in the same environment.
We are trying to equip ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of people here that speak fluent Mexican.
Mm.
And like I say, Paul, who is our he's a minister. He's one of our youth ministers who runs the youth missionary team. Went down there, it's been a year or more ago, and invited them, you know, and offered any kind of assistance to them. And we haven't heard from them. We have some people have walked in. Well, we have some Mexican people in the daycare and stuff. And some have come in with some needs and clothes, and, you know, we've helped them, you know, with what we can help them with. So we are embracing them if they want to come. I think First Baptist probably has a better ministry to them as far as communication. But we're trying to develop that now. So probably what we would suggest is that, you know, they would go over there first, you know, because they are more equipped to, you know, to get the message. You know, my thing is not so much the people, it's salvation. It's really changing your life. You know, that's what it's all about. And where they get it from, I'm not concerned. But we are not at the point now where we can really effectively, I think, minister to them. You know, we can help. We'll do anything possible to help them, but I would steer them to somebody that would more be able to reach them. You know what I mean? Now, the ones that understand English or something is not a problem. And we do have a couple that come mainly through relationships with women. You know? I haven't seen him around lately, but he was coming kind of faithfully there at one time. But he doesn't stay long enough to help. You know, we can't snatch him in to, to help us, you know. So it'll come eventually.
So you think a language barrier might be part of the...
Yeah, for us.
I see. Okay.
You know, and the way that our service goes, you know, for somebody to translate while the service is going on and all that kind of stuff. So we just have to find a way to reach them, and we will.
But you are, to the extent of if they're in material... need, there are things that you can provide.
We've given milk and bread and clothes, and, you know, we got a whole trailer back there with furniture and cribs and mattresses, and, you know, people need stuff, you know. So that's why I'm saying, don't kick the door and come ask for it.
Within the context of just sort of the changes that are taking place in Northeast Central Durham neighborhoods right now, I wanted to just get your conception of what makes a strong community in general, and where this community needs to go to reach that point, if it's not there already.
Well, I think what makes any community stronger is good morals, good moral character. And to be frank, the schools are not giving good moral character these days. So where do you get that from? Other than the church. There are a lot of churches who will remain nameless that don't go outside the doors. They don't. They just have their service, and if somebody comes and joins, fine. If not, but I don't know. Maybe that's the vision they have, or I don't know. But the word says go out unto all of the world. You know? So this church is here for the neighborhood. We are here to help. We are here to offer salvation to people, to teach them about Jesus, that there's another lifestyle, that you can replace those guns with a Bible, and that you don't have to live that way. And our slogan is changing Durham for Christ, one prayer at a time. And that's what it takes, one person at a time. And every one of these people that we reach around here, or whoever reaches, I don't care who reaches them, but somebody has to come outside these church doors and deal with these people. You know, a lot of churches have foreign missions. They run all over to India and Africa. But I've seen kids come out of these places that look like they just ran out of Haiti or something like that. So there's work right here in this neighborhood, as well as the entire Durham area, but I'm saying we're not in the entire Durham area. We're here for this neighborhood. And I think And I've seen it. You know, we have kids here that we picked up from these same neighborhoods years ago. Their parents started to come. They don't live there anymore. They're driving cars. They're getting off the welfare. They're getting rid of the food stamps. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because they're bettering themselves, because their moral character has changed. Their lifestyle has changed. And they want to better themselves. I mean, at one time, our van, we didn't make the 5 trips. Now we can hardly find anybody to pick up because they're all driving nice cars. Mm. Just coming out of those same few gardens and all these places.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I know it can make a difference, because it's already happened, you know. And I see kids that I had to stop the van and read the riot act too, you know. Now they're right on in with the rest of them, you know.
Is there a way to sort of get a perception of how, what kids' mindset is to diversity, to different ethnic groups? I know you've talked about sort of an adult mentality, but have you been able to observe kids in interaction with other kids different than they are?
Yes, because when I do pick up some Mexican children, I kind of feel that we have to protect them somewhat, and then when I look at it, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I know when we go over to this one particular place, and we just 3 children we pick up there, and they look like little doll babies, you know. And they get on the bus, and they're quiet, you know. They're not behavior problems, and. You know, at first, you know, oh, here, we're getting some Mexican kids and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then one girl says, oh, they're cute. You know, they're this, they're that. So you kind of feel that, you know, a little overprotective towards them, because you don't want something to happen that would, you know, keep them from coming or something like that. But then again, when I look, you know, I get into my route and I look back, you know, everybody's on the bus ride, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to put my finger on it. I guess it's a strange thing. I think anytime you introduce something different, especially to children, you know, that they have to adjust to it, you know. Mm-hmm.